That's the sound of a mellotron, an early synthesizer that in the 1960s used loops of tape that had recordings of samples of instruments. What you're hearing is the beginning of Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles. Is this the exact same instrument that was played by Rod Argent from the Zombies on their album Odyssey and Oracle? I asked the Zombies bass player, Chris White, if Rod had borrowed it from the Beatles.
No, he didn't borrow it. It was left in the studio by John Lennon.
Is it? Now, is it the one that's on Sgt. Pepper?
I think so. We don't know. We assume that there's one in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Ohio, which is John Lennon's, and we sort of recognise it, but they all look the same anyway.
Chris White from the Zombies is my special guest on this week's London Calling. I'm Graham Mack, and let's have a look at what's happening in Britain this week. Well, the big news is the UK doesn't have a government right now. There's a dissolution of Parliament. There's going to be a general election in the UK on the 8th of June. Before every general election, the current Parliament must come to an end. All members of Parliament, MPs, leave their jobs, ready for the public to choose who'll get their job next. By law, Parliament is dissolved 25 working days before a general election takes place. Here's what it means. From the moment Parliament is dissolved, MPs are no longer MPs. They become members of the public again and can't use MP after their name, which seems a little unfair because Member of Parliament and Member of Public still have the initials MP. All of the official business that usually takes place in the House of Commons has to come to an end. This is so the people formerly known as MPs can concentrate on lying to the public so that they can con us into voting for them. So now you know all there is to know about the dissolution of Parliament. Not to be confused with the dissolution of the voters. The actor Tom Hardy is a have-a-go hero. This happened in London at the weekend. He saw two teenagers on a motorbike run a red light, then crash into a Mercedes and then give it tows. He chased after them, ran through gardens and eventually caught them. So we're talking about have-a-go heroes. Ken.
Many, many years ago, I lived in Hartford and I was walking home from the pub. And I saw an incident, a lad on the ground and two people attacking him.
Wow.
One was stabbing him, which I thought was a knife. The other one was hitting him with a baseball bat.
Goodness me, serious?
Seriously.
Yeah.
So I ran over there and shouted out, the police are on their way, the police are on their way.
Even though they weren't?
Even though they weren't.
Yeah.
This was long before days of mobile phones.
Yeah.
And the two chaps jumped in a car and drove off. I took the registration number, saw the lad was okay, phoned the police.
And had he been stabbed?
It was with a screwdriver. I thought it was a knife. It was a screwdriver.
But they stabbed him?
Yes.
Wow.
And hit him with a baseball bat.
Wow.
So the police came. The two people concerned were trapped and went to court.
Yeah.
But they were given very, very lenient sentences.
Oh, why?
Oh, well, I'll come to that. Anyway, went to court. I was told by the police I didn't have to turn up because, as a witness, who said agreed to plead guilty.
Mm-hmm.
I was given lenient sentences. Anyway, a couple of months later, I was coming home from football training, and lo and behold, I was attacked by these two blokes.
No.
So I defended myself with one, and the other one jumped in the car and they run off. Next thing, I was arrested for attacking them.
Brilliant, yeah.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, what happened is that they got lenient sentences because they were grafting to the police.
Oh, were they? They were informers, yeah.
But that's not the end of the story. They were parked up one night outside what was then Zero's nightclub in Hartford.
Yeah.
Young girl had a row with a boyfriend, came out, jumped in the car thinking it was a taxi.
Right.
They drove her off, raped her and burnt her with cigarettes. And they were eventually nicked.
And did they get a proper sentence in the end?
Yes.
But if only they'd locked him up in the first place.
Exactly.
This
well,
is...
I reported to the police for intimidating a witness.
You what?
I reported them because they came after me.
Yeah.
Because I was a witness against them.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, surely they're intimidating a witness.
Yeah.
The police didn't want to know because they wanted him out on the streets because they were grassing to the local police.
So do you know how long they got, Ken?
For the original attack,
yeah,
they got, I think it's 18 months, suspended for 2 years.
Which means they didn't get locked up. This suspended sentence, it means nothing. Either lock them up
on
or
the streets.
Don't. You what?
The police wanted them on the streets.
Oh, but that's right, to keep the info coming, yeah. Yeah.
And when they got done, they eventually got done for the rape case.
Yeah.
I can't remember what they got. But I think if the police had investigated it first time...
Yeah.
The young girl's life wouldn't have been ruined.
Exactly. I mean, police need grasses. They need informers. But if someone is clearly violent...
Exactly.
...then they need to be taken off the street. If someone is a violent offender, they need to be locked up. The thing with a violent offender is... The violent offenders need to be warehoused. We need to warehouse the bad guys. That's how you'll make the streets safer. Not by letting the violent offenders walk the street just because they're grassing on other people. I mean, that's the violent ones is a whole different deal.
Well, the police turned a blind eye to it.
Unbelievable. Just because it makes the police work easier.
It was investigated by the police complaints authority.
It was, yeah.
Via my MP at the time.
Yeah.
The police just hushed it up. They didn't want to know.
Well, that's the police for you. We got too many. I mean, you know, most coppers are decent blokes. And I feel sorry for them because they know who the villains are, but they can't get them locked up. But you've just got these few bad eggs in the police force that give all the decent coppers a bad name.
Exactly.
And they really need to weed them out, but they seem to do the opposite. You know, they're like the Catholic Church. They just try to cover up the problems
exactly.
Rather than try and say, no, we want to run a better police service, and we're only going to do that by weeding out these bad people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The public feel bad about the police then.
Yeah, when really, and it isn't even most of the police that are like this.
No.
You'd think that the police, to protect their own reputation, would want to weed out the scumbags. But no, they seem to protect each other regardless of whether they're good coppers or not. I don't know. I don't know. Hey, Ken, thank you very much.
Okay, Graham.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
I think I've worked out how to save the planet. We keep hearing about how fossil fuels are bad for the environment and how they're eventually going to run out anyway. So there's no future in that. As long as we generate electricity from renewable sources, the answer has to be electric cars. Now, I've been thinking about this lately. The new Macmobile is a hybrid. It's petrol and electric. So I'm kind of halfway there. But I have been wondering about, why not go all the way? Why not go all electric? And so last night, I woke up in the middle of the night with the answer. Electric cars haven't caught on yet. And the reason most people give for not buying them is electric cars don't have the range. Well, range isn't really the issue. Some Tesla models can go for 300 miles on a single charge. The real problem is the time it takes to charge them up. It takes hours. If your battery goes flat and you're not at your final destination, you're knackered. If there's nowhere to charge it up when you get there, you can't get home. I can't get a fully electric car because I live in a block of flats with nowhere to charge it. I can't plug it in at work. And if there was somewhere to charge it between home and work, I'd have to add a few hours to my commute while I waited for it to charge up. The answer is pretty simple. Removable batteries. If you had an electric car with, let's say, 4 removable batteries, each one powerful enough to run the car's motor individually for, say, 100 miles. have it set up so the car uses one battery until it's dead, and then it switches to the next one. When you stop at a charging station, all you have to do is take out the dead batteries and replace them with fully charged ones. That way, you'd be able to refuel an electric car in just a few minutes, probably quicker than you could fill up a petrol car. The dead batteries could then be charged at the charging station. And when they're fully charged, they'd be ready to be exchanged for dead ones from the next electric car driver. Stick a wind turbine and solar cells at the charging station, and the electricity to charge the batteries would be generated without harming the environment or taking resources from the national grid. So, electric cars are the future, but not until we make them so that you can take the batteries out. Let's check in with Mick.
Hi, Graham, what about Have a Go Heroes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in Hitchin at work, and I was dinner time. I went into the market square, and I heard a scream.
Yeah.
And I see this bloke run in the middle of the square. That he jumped over a couple of cars, and I thought, what's he doing? And no one was stopping him. And then he jumped onto this bloke and started laying into this bloke. And I'm thinking, this is wrong here. No one's doing anything about it. And
yeah.
Then 2 minutes later, I heard someone shout, "Cut." They were filming, weren't they?
Dr. Foster, it's filmed in Hitchin. A lot of it's filmed in the square.
I wonder why no one was doing anything. I was about to run in and do something, but...
Mate, you would have been in the show.
This is London Calling.
Is it a sport? This week, Mark Selby became a world champion for the third time in 4 years. He's the world champion in snooker. The game of snooker is a mystery to most Americans. Let me clear some things up. First of all, it's called snooker, not snooker. Snooker's a bit like pool, but the players in the UK are classed as sportsmen. In fact, the snooker player Steve Davis has finished in the top three of the BBC's Sports Personality of the Year 5 times. Snooker is a game where the players can drink alcohol while they're playing. Bill Werbenick, who played in the 70s and early 80s, once drank 76 cans of beer during a game with John Spencer. He used to claim lager as a tax deduction. Now, back when Bill played, the World Championships was sponsored by a tobacco company, and players used to smoke during the games. Now, I can remember watching, I think it was BBC One, actually. It was one Saturday afternoon in the early 80s. And it was the Embassy World Snooker World Championship. Embassy brand of cigarettes. And I forget who was playing. I think it was John Davis. Anyway, they broke into the transmission to cross live to the SAS storming the Iranian embassy. It was a big story. And I forget the player's name, but the players were smoking on camera. And the joke was afterwards, who smokes more embassies, the SAS or the snooker players? Because they were just puffing their way through the sponsor's product. It was total product placement. And it was on the BBC for a product that it was illegal to advertise. Amazing days. The big tournaments here are televised and presented in much the same way as, say, golf is covered. There's commentators, analysis, and snooker gets similar viewing figures to the big sporting events. Snooker is definitely a game. But is it a sport? Well, that depends on how you define sport. I can't remember who first said this, but I agree with them. It's only a sport if you can't do it while you're wearing your normal shoes. Mark Selby is a world champion, but snooker is not a sport. There's a podcast getting a lot of publicity right now called S-Town. I started listening to it last week and was enjoying it, but I was worried that it might not have an ending. And guess what? I was right. It didn't have an ending. I was so disappointed. Jim McCabe is on Skype from Philadelphia. Jim, you listened to it too. Can you believe it's had 17 million downloads?
Wow.
That's some going.
It must be based on the first few episodes.
Yeah, because at the end there, like I was worried, it didn't have an ending. They didn't tuck it in. And the same thing
you
with Siri.
I thought of this. Hmm. The last little bit, talking of how John B's property became his property.
Mm-hmm.
That could have very easily been the opening to the last episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it so if it could have been the opening, it's a shitty ending.
Yeah.
Because it sums nothing up.
No, you don't find anything out. We don't solve the mystery of the murder. We don't find where his fortune is. We don't find his motivation for the suicide. We find out we are left completely unfulfilled.
So what he ended with, it could have very easily been the opening to the entire show.
Yeah.
And if it could have been the opening, that's a shitty ending.
That's how you define a bad ending. Yeah.
You know, an ending is something that goes, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got it. Yeah. You know what? It makes sense.
Yeah. Especially when you've invested the best part of 7 hours in this thing.
Yes.
You want a payoff. And it was going superb up until the end of episode 2 or 3, or the first 3. Wonderful. But then the next
it's got a nice pace to it.
It's lovely.
You're listening and you go, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And like you said, up to the fifth episode,
yeah,
there's still that you want more.
Yeah.
And then it kind of goes,
yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah. It just went, this is pretty much all we've got now. We're done. We've run out. We were running on fumes for the last half an hour, and now the tank is empty. That's, but it's getting all this critical acclaim, and it is a wonderfully made, crafted thing, but the structure of beginning, middle, and end, the very basic of storytelling is absent. And I don't know how you can give that critical acclaim. You know, and they could have done it with just looking at it. Where are we going to end? We've got to look for an ending. Once we find an ending, everything else that we do will lead us to that. Even if it's a surprise ending, everything you do is don't tip the bit. Or if it's a tuck in ending, well, then you keep setting things up ready to think when they get to the ending, this is really going to work.
And there was something I wrote while I was out. I literally wrote it on the bridge of a ship.
Mm-hmm.
As I was on watch. I should have been looking out the window. I wasn't. Just a short film. And I had no idea what I was doing.
Hmm.
I wrote it. I brought it home and we filmed it.
Wow.
And a friend of mine said, oh, wow, this is a great, it's 4 or 5 minutes long, but it literally has 3 acts.
Right. Yeah.
It has a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And I had no idea that it had a beginning, middle, end until someone said to me, oh, this is, it's great. It's got 3 acts.
Right.
I had no idea that I was just, you know, storytelling is this integral part of us.
Yes. It's like
that. Just this short that I almost, and I wrote it as an exercise because what my friends and I have always done, it's been heavy dialogue. So yeah. I did something that it was had almost zero dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the story had a beginning, middle, and an end.
Because that's the natural way to tell a story. If you take the most...
Yes, it had a three-act structure, even though I had no idea that it had a three-act structure.
You naturally went that way when you told the story.
Yes.
To do it any other way is actually unnatural. It's almost... You'd have to work harder. Because really, in effect, if you don't have the three acts, you don't have a story.
You don't have a story. And so... For S-Town to just sort of go, just peter out.
Yeah.
After this, it's really this the end of the second act.
It peters out, and you know.
He just kind of goes.
But the scary thing is, you and I are the only people in the world saying, "Nah, it wasn't that good. It was disappointing." Everybody else, it's like. People are now scared to mention it because it's got all this critical acclaim. You know, it's like 2001 Space Odyssey, Kubrick. You seen that?
I haven't, actually.
Okay. It is mind-blowing. Literally is mind-blowing. For Kubrick to make that in 1968, before man had even been to the moon, man had flown in space, but they hadn't even had Apollo 8 by that stage, where they went to the moon and went round the back. The yeah. way he films life in space and on long duration space flight, pretty much every movie that has followed that has been about the realistic depiction of weightlessness of it, every one of them has followed Kubrick 2001. But the film itself is a piece of crap because the ending is just beyond bizarre. It's in three acts, but the three acts aren't even connected. It literally is in three acts, but they're completely unconnected. It is, and it's long, and it's so beautiful. And the use of music and the cinematography, beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't start or finish anywhere. It like starts, three times it starts, and three times it fails to finish because the acts aren't even connected. And that's critically acclaimed, and you're not really supposed to knock Kubrick, you know.
yeah.
But it's terrible. Oh, yeah, well, who are you, you know? This is Stanley Kubrick. Well, big deal. Shining was fantastic. This, garbage.
Yeah. You know what? You know who I am? I'm an audience member.
Yeah.
And I realized, this sucks.
Yeah. I think that's what we've got here with S-Town. S-Town or the makers of This American Life, Brian Reed, he is the Stanley Kubrick of podcasting because it's beautifully made and, you know, so well done. The work in it is phenomenal, crafted thing. But the yeah. basic of Tell Me a Damn Story is missing.
Yeah, it really is. It's just, there's... Yes, it has an ending. It's in the fact that it stops.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nothing is tied together. Nothing is solved. You don't feel as you said, there's more questions. It doesn't really answer any question that it raises.
Not a single question.
So why bother?
Yeah. Here's how Brian Reed would tell a knock-knock joke. Knock-knock.
Knock-knock. John B. lives in Shittown, Alabama.
Yeah.
Oh, who's there?
I don't really know. I can't answer that. But
other people?
Yeah. It's just... Ugh. Shit town. Shit podcast. Waste of time. Ma,
and
it's got redeeming features. You know, there are interesting things to it. But it's like, it's almost like they could have just gone, well, we've got all this audio. What can we do with it? Well, why don't we do a show about horology? And there's some bits in there we can use. This is John B. McLemore. He was a horologist in Woodstock, Alabama. And he still could do get the gold onto the clock face using mercury, which is a dangerous process. Here's audio of him doing it. Okay. Sadly, he took his own life not long after we made this program. But here's something else you probably didn't realize about horology. You know?
And now the sun has set. So the sundials are ineffective. That's an ending.
Yes. Yes. The sun set on the sundial industry.
Done. Done.
Done. An ending. An ending. But this Brian Reed,
yes.
There's another great podcast I really like called...
Yes. And don't do fire gilding because it's awful.
Yeah. And it could turn you crazy. It's poisonous. Yeah. Oh.
And I love the fact that in the last episode, they bring up the fact of mercury poisoning.
Yeah.
And then he says, and there's no way to prove it. Because he dedicates the first half of the last episode saying, oh yes, he probably had mercury poisoning, but there's no way to prove it now because mercury gets out of your system quite fast. So
yeah,
we can't test for it anymore.
Yeah.
So bring up something you can't prove.
Yeah. Yeah. Just throw it in there. It's just pure speculation.
And then at the same time he says, oh yes, and you know, mad as a hatter.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And then we can't prove this.
No.
But also, at the same time, there was bad things happening in John B's life.
Mm.
So that could have been it too.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Oh, so the entire beginning of this episode, you've just nullified.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not great storytelling. And Brian Reed, there's a podcast I really like called Here's the Thing, which is Alec Baldwin, who's a terrific interviewer. He's now got Brian Reed as his guest on Here's the Thing now, based on S-Town.
Oh.
So, I haven't listened to it. I've only just seen that it's in my inbox thing, but I'm going to listen to it. But I bet Alec Baldwin, who's a fantastic interviewer,
S-Town's great.
He's going to, of course he is. He's not going, I might be wrong, but I'll wait till I've heard it. But he's not going to go, you really stuck for an ending there, weren't you? He's just going to go, oh, tell me how this came about. Tell me. Yeah. If he's on that, Brian Reed's probably going to be in all the late night chat show, especially the nerdy ones, the later ones.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know why. 17 million downloads. I don't get it.
And I was talking to the mate of mine that I recommended S-Town to as well.
That's the problem, is you hear the first two or three and you go, I must recommend this. I know who'll like this. And you recommend it to them.
At that point, you're hooked.
Yeah, it's because it's good. And you think it's going somewhere.
But even I gave him the same heads up that you gave me that... This episode, I think it was the sixth episode.
Yeah, it's a bit.
Gets a little bit, gratuitous. I'll say.
Yes.
And it doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be in there.
Because it doesn't, if they had an end and they were working towards the end and that was a real part of what was, you know, his motivation, for instance, for the suicide, well, then fine. Then now we can see how conflicted the guy was, and this is, but no, there's no need for it. But when you look at it, because there's no ending, there's no need for any of it.
But even still, that when it gets really graphic with I forget the guy's name.
Yeah, it's the guy. The guy from Megaphone.
There's just no need for that.
No, not at all.
They could have completely edited it out and just cut to, you know, I should have. My biggest regret is not looking over at him and saying, "Hey, I want to kiss you right now."
They could have
ended it right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no need to get as graphic as they did.
No, no need at all. Oh, just.
And yes, and I
it's like
you know, I have no problem with anyone being gay.
None at all. Neither do I. That's your thing.
Just don't want to see it. I don't want to hear it.
I think, you know, whenever they make these shows about people who are gay, they usually dwell on the, you know, what goes on. They dwell on it, you know, with specific examples of what they were doing. You take a heterosexual person, you know, if John was heterosexual, and he'd had relationships. If a show went along and found ex-girlfriends, for instance, they wouldn't be talking in graphic detail about what happened in the bedroom. They're only doing that because he was gay. I think that's a huge discrimination against gay people. Is that doesn't define who that they're your sexuality doesn't define who you are to that degree that we have to know exactly what goes on in your bedroom. It doesn't if you're heterosexual. How come it does when you're gay? And I think the gay community needs to stand up and say.
If there was that degree in a podcast,
it'd be
well, this is porn.
Yeah, yeah. If you were talking about a heterosexual couple, consenting adults, and what they do. No, you can say they were in a relationship. This is his girlfriend, or this is whatever. But it's not when you're interviewing the girlfriend. Well, tell me about what the kind of things you used to get up to in the bedroom. Well, they would be like, don't be absurd. But when somebody's gay,
no one would ask that question in the first place.
But when someone's gay, they usually go there. Well, that discriminates against gay. If gay people want rights, then the right of respect for what goes on in their bedroom, the rule of none of your business, should apply to gay people too.
Yes.
But it doesn't. Society is so messed up. We think we've got all this equality and stuff, and we really don't. It's not fair on the gay community that what goes on in the bedroom is so much more of a bigger deal. It just shows you it still is. They're still regarded, gay people are still regarded as freaks, and that we need to know what goes on. Well, that's not equality.
Or it's Brian Reed or the editors saying, this is how accepting we are.
Yeah, that we're okay to put, yeah, yeah. When it's the opposite.
This is how much I embrace the gay community. We're going to put this in.
Yeah. You wouldn't do that with a heterosexual person.
No.
And I think the gay community need to stand up. I don't know if they see it, but they do need to stand up and go, this is not important. This is people's private business. Just like a heterosexual couple. Why are you going into graphic detail just because they're gay?
And it didn't advance the narrative at all.
Because
there was no narrative at that point.
They'd actually roped that bloke in he wasn't even in the story. He had no connection to any other part of the story. They could have probably found, you know, three or four different people that John had had relationships with over the period of his adult life that he found on dating sites or whatever. I'm sure he wasn't the only one, this fella, and we could have asked them too. It would have been just as irrelevant to the story that was being told. He wasn't like the last person to see him alive, or there was no reason for that character to even be in the story, never mind get to the graphic detail of what they got up to in the bedroom. It was just irrelevant.
Completely irrelevant.
Oh, I don't know. Really, I really, really don't know. So disappointing. But the most disappointing thing of all is 17 million downloads and critical acclaim. That's the most disappointing thing of all.
Yes, and of course there's going to be critical acclaim because they have the Brokeback Mountain aspect of it from
Yeah.
Woodstock, Alabama. From Shittown, Alabama.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah. That's what pushed it over the edge, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Probably. Yeah.
We're this accepting of the gay community, so much so, we're making an entire podcast of it.
Actually...
For no reason.
It ticks a few boxes that Oscar-winning movies...
Yeah, it's that same thing. It's that this is we're going to win awards.
Yeah, because it's
we're not telling a story. We're going to win awards.
Yeah, it's got the great performances. It's got the great work in making it as a beautiful crafted piece. It ticks the box of it touches the homosexual community. It touches racism in rural America.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
It's like it ticked all the boxes that usually, if it was a movie, would have wanted an Oscar. I think that's why it gets the critical acclaim. It's, you know, it touches on police corruption, the relationship between the police and the community, you know, all these other things. It ticks these boxes.
And it's, you can't be on the negative side of it. You cannot come out of it. You cannot, in the United States, you cannot come out on the other side of it.
In what way? What do you mean?
Because, oh, you didn't like it? Well, then you're racist.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Or you're homophobic.
Exactly. Yes. And that's probably what's stopping a lot of people from saying, you know what? It's rubbish.
Oh, this is shit.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? Shit town is just shit.
Yes. You don't
because
need
you,
to town.
You can't publicly say that.
No, you can't.
Because, oh, no. Then you're racist.
Yeah. Yeah, or you got a problem with gay people or whatever it is.
Yes, there's no downside for them.
Let's get to this week's special guest. It's Chris White, the bass player from The Zombies. Last time I talked to him, he talked about how the band started and how they rose to fame. Let's talk about what happened next. 1967, you toured the Philippines. Now, the Beatles had been there a year earlier and had some real issues. How was it for you?
We had similar problems.
Oh, really?
We found out that we thought we got offered a job by our manager there for £100 a night between us.
Oh.
For 10 days, but the people hiring us would pay accommodation, food, everything, transport. But when we arrived, we didn't realize that we had three records in their top 20, and we were playing the second biggest Astrodome next to Houston. So we were playing for 30,000 people a night for 10 nights for £100 between us.
Wow.
And then we got told that we were being ripped off, so we asked for more money for the option period, and then we were told, no, you had to leave. And a consortium of people, including the mayor of Manila's godson, put us together and said, we'll pay you £1,000 a night. And then we got threatened, and basically each club we played at one club after this new we got the new deal, and it was threatened and burnt down the next morning. And so we had to move this out. So it's quite a story. In fact, there's going to be a musical about the whole thing, about the creation of Odyssey and Oracle starting at that period.
I see. That was the beginning of it, because it's now 50 years since the album Odyssey and Oracle. Well, 50 years since it was recorded, wasn't it? It came out in 68. Yeah.
68. Yeah. In 67 in England, but 68 in America.
The summer is here at last. The sky is overcast and no one as her flowers grow, while lovers come and go to give each other roses from her tree, but not a rose for Emily. Emily,
Emily,
can't you see there's nothing you can do?
The sun is shining.
There's loving everywhere, but fading now. She keeps her pride somehow. That's all she has, protecting her from pain. And as the years go by, she will grow old and die. The roses in her garden fade away. for her grave, not a rose for Emily. Emily, can't you see there's nothing you can do? There's loving everywhere but love for you. Her roses are fading now. She keeps her pride somehow. That's all she has protecting her from pain. And as the years go by, she will grow old and die. The roses in her garden fade away. Not one left for her grave. Not a rose for Emily.
Basically, we came back from the Philippines with no manager, no record deal, and no money.
Yeah.
So Rod and I wanted to produce, so we got a deal with CBS in England, and they gave us £1,000 to record in Abbey Road. So.
Wow. And back then, £1,000 compared to what would normally be the budget for a major album?
Well, I don't know, because we never got an advance before that. So basically, we actually had so... We had so much time, we had a time constraint, and so we had to rehearse totally before we went to the studio. And we did 3-hour sessions, and some of them we did 3 backing tracks in 3 hours, because it was only on 4-track, you see, so we had to be correct.
I read that the budget was so tight on that one that Rod had to play a borrowed Mellotron.
No, he didn't borrow it. It was left in the studio by John Lennon.
Is it? Now, is it the one that's on Sgt. Pepper?
I think so. We don't know. We assume that. There's one in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Ohio, which is John Lennon's, and we sort of recognise it, but they all look the same anyway.
Yeah. Oh, you might as well claim it anyway.
I think we do, yes.
I knew her when summer was her crown, and autumn said how brown her eyes. I knew her when winter was her cloak, and spring her voice she spoke to me.
Silver and gold, strawberry clothes, money will buy something to hold. See in her eyes, nothing will last, like emerald stones and platinum clasps.
I knew her when summer was her crown, and autumn said how brown her eyes. I knew her when winter was her cloak, and spring her voice she spoke to me.
By something to hold, see in her eyes, nothing will last, like emerald stones and platinum.
I knew her when summer was her crown, and autumn said how brown her eyes. I knew her when winter was her cloak, and spring her voice she spoke to me. I knew her when summer was
her crown, and autumn sad how brown her eyes.
Now, why is it that Odyssey is spelt incorrectly on the album?
Well, my flatmate, who I was at art college and same school with, Rod and I were staying with, living in the same flat as him, and he said he'd do a cover for us, and we were busy recording, so he showed us a sketch, and it was just all that flowery sort of writing.
Oh, it's stunning.
Yeah, and he'd spelt it wrong.
Right.
He's now a teacher, well, he's retired now. But we then made up a story to cover it when we came back and the company had got it, and we still spelt wrong on the finished cover. And so Rod and I came up with the story that it was a cross between an ode and an odyssey.
Right, good save.
Well, it was, except that, funny enough, and only last couple of years, Rod said that in front of Colin in an interview, and Colin said, Is that what really happened? He said, I've been believing it all the time that it was a cross between an odyssey. And we finally found out the truth that it was just a spelling mistake.
Now, you and Rod, you personally paid for the stereo mixes on the album.
Yes, the point was the writers earned more money than the other members of the group because of the publishing. And the others didn't have any money. So we paid for the stereo mix because it was suddenly, the record company suddenly said, oh, well, we need it in stereo as well as mono.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in this time to promised lands, to show you everyone it's the time of the season for love me. What's your name?
Your daddy. Who's
your daddy?
Be rich.
Is he rich like me? Has he taken
any time to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
Like me,
has he taken
any time
to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
nobody wanted the album afterwards, and the band split up because the other three members couldn't afford to live. As simple as that.
That's why the Zombies split up. It was because there was no money.
That's right.
There's no money in it.
There wasn't. We weren't getting the gigs. Paul Atkinson was getting married. Rod and I wanted to continue, so we put the group Argent together and co-produced and co-wrote. We put our joint names on everything we wrote. And then we brought Colin back in from... We went to do a job, proper job. And we did his first three albums as well, solo albums.
Right, but the album itself, Odyssey and Oracle, didn't really sell that well at first, did it?
It did nothing. Nothing at all.
Time of the Season was a huge hit on its own.
After we split up, 8 months later.
Had you lost faith in the album by that stage?
No, it wasn't a matter of faith. Rod and I wanted to continue because we were the creative side of the writers and producers. So we didn't lose faith. We knew it was a good album. It was the best we could do. But then we were onto new projects. And then...
Yeah, well, it's in the top 100 on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time.
I know. Isn't that a nice thing to happen in 50 years later? It's a great pleasure playing to the Americans because they really appreciate it. And we do it as we recorded it, note for note, with Mellotrons and everything that we did, you know. So it's done.
You take an actual Mellotron on the road? Or
we take two Mellotrons. Because we've actually...
Really? So you haven't... It's not a sample, a synthesizer. It is an actual Mellotron. It's two actual Mellotrons.
Those are too dangerous, the old... Because the tapes used to break. So these are...
Yeah.
They are Mellotrons, but they're the digital ones.
Okay, so it's the same. Instead of having a tape loop of the sound, you've got the recording of the sound as a digital recording. So that is the same, yeah.
It is the same. And, of course, we have with us Darian Sahanaja, who's Brian Wilson's main man,
mm-hmm.
who helped him put Smile back together and everything. And he loves it. And he knows Odyssey and Oracle so inside out that he tells us when we're wrong.
Good to have a fan on board, yeah?
He's a fan and a great writer. He's a wonderful player as well. He does all the Mellotron parts that Rod had to overdub on the album.
Now, you were a non-performing songwriter in Argent. Why didn't you want to perform?
There were better bass players. I'm more of a writer and producer. And And of course, when we split up, the Zombies, Rod said, why don't we put our joint names on all the songs we write? Because we need one song to make money.
Yeah.
So I said, well, that's very generous of you, Rod. And then the first big hit we had was Hold Your Head Up, which I wrote.
Really? But you had both names on it? Yeah.
We never regretted it. Rod always gives me credit for it. But and we do it, they do it on stage in this current Odyssey and Oracle thing as well, because it's entrenched in the Zombies, really, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
But it seemed sensible, and it was generous of Rod to offer, because he'd written She's Not There and Time of the Season when we were the Zombies, and he suggested it. And that was very generous, and it's been great. We're all friends. That's the nice thing about the Zombies. We were friends for 55 years.
And if it's bad, don't let it get you down. You can take it. And if it hurts, don't let them see.
At that time, the Zombies were still in demand in America, and there were at least two bands touring the States claiming to be the Zombies, even though they had none of the original members. Did anyone from the real Zombies try to stop them?
Yeah, Rod and I tried to stop them when we were in America. But under American law, as we didn't exist, per se, as the Zombies, we couldn't sue, or they just could use the name.
Well, who owned the name?
Well, we didn't own the name. You can't do that in America. Under the law, they can actually call themselves the Zombies, you see.
Right.
So it's by inference. And actually, we found out last year that I think one or two of ZZ Top went out as the Zombies in the early days.
Yeah, Frank Beard, the
That's
drummer,
right, yeah.
Frank Beard, was in one of the fake Zombies.
That's right.
Because I think one of them was from Texas.
That's right, yeah.
Have you come across Frank at any time?
We haven't yet. But I mean, the management were reluctant to own up to it, but the band reluctantly admitted it in the end. And all they ever did was do their southern music and then just play Time of the Season. That's all they did.
The rest of the set list was their stuff.
Yes, yes.
But from what I've seen, they sometimes didn't get very good reviews. Did that cause any problems for the real zombies?
Well, because we weren't in existence then, so it didn't really matter to us. We were only just Rod and Colin only got together in the turn of the century, really, basically. And they started off as Rod Argent and Colin Blundstone, but then people kept calling them the zombies, so that's what they did in the end.
So what was the inspiration for the full reunion?
Originally, it was 40 years, and the first time we'd played the album ever. And that
right,
was in Shepherd's
I see.
Bush Empire.
Because it would have been impossible up until probably 20 years ago to even play the album, wouldn't it? Because of the technology, stage technology moving on, I suppose?
Probably. But, I mean, they're all good musicians. And don't forget, it was only recorded on 4-track.
I see. Right. Okay. Yeah. You got to remember that. You got to remember that back then. Yeah.
I think the simplicity of it makes it more successful to younger groups now. So that's the secret, I suppose.
Okay. The tour continues. Where does it end?
In Los Angeles in May, early May.
There's a Palladium show coming up here, isn't there, as well?
There is, yes. We're only the last people to hear about where we're exactly playing. But yes, I was very pleased to see that we're doing a show at the Palladium.
And when's that?
June the 2nd, I think.
That's after the US thing's wrapped up. There's a special at the Palladium.
I think we're doing a festival in Barcelona as well.
Okay.
So this is the last time we're performing the Odyssey and Oracle, really, just the 50s, because everyone wants to go forward. And it's nice to do Odyssey and Oracle, but music, we don't want to be a sort of retro sort of sampler group, really.
A tribute act to yourselves.
Yes. I'm beginning not to look like myself now.
And so will there be new Zombies material in the future?
Yes, well, Rod and Colin have got the current band, great musicians, and they're still doing new stuff. I think that's what makes it fresh. The new band do their current stuff, and then we revert back to the second half where we do the whole of Odyssey and Oracle. So it's a nice look back at where we come from, and going forward, the band. I'm not involved with the new stuff, but we're still all friends, you know. So
yeah, and there's an Odyssey and Oracle book coming out this month as well.
It is, and funnily enough, it's such a family event, this, because on stage at the moment, Jim Rodford, who used to be with Argent and the Kinks, was the first person to help the band get together. He's now the current bass player, and his son, Steve Rodford, is the drummer. My wife is on tour with us singing, and she also illustrated the new book with each song. She's done a picture for each one, so it's a real family affair.
It really is, and there's a remastered version of the album on the way too.
Oh, yes, there seems to be. You know, we're the last to find out, but I mean, we're having to keep signing different covers that I haven't seen before.
And then what's next for Chris White?
Well, we are working on a musical about that period, the Philippines and the creation of Odyssey and Oracle, in the same vein as the Jersey Boys, but it's in process at the moment, and we're doing talks about it, so.
Look forward to that. Chris White, thank you very much for your time. It's been an honour to talk to you, and continued success with the tour and everything else.
Thank you, and to you, Graham. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. Next week, my guest is Mike Brewer from one of the world's most watched TV shows about cars, Wheeler Dealers. Find out how a car salesman from South London became an internationally famous TV presenter. Mike Brewer, next week on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email, put your phone number or your Skype details in that email. I might put you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time, ta-da!